Okay. Couple of announcements. So I put a date for the project C, project part C. It's due on November 30th, and that's pretty much the hard deadline. You know, you should hopefully try to get done before that, because right after that, the TA is going to have demos for the, you know, you're supposed to demo your entire project to him. So he's going to have one-on-one demos with you guys. And then actually I think the week after 11:30 basically we end, the semester ends. So that's part of the reason why it's a hard deadline. Homework 4, I just closed it as it was and made it due next Monday. Okay, so I'm still keeping my 1 week warning thing. Okay, there is a thing that it's not yet been announced, but you know, look out in your mail, or probably I'll send a mail. So the guys who are starting Google Phoenix division are, one of the guys is actually going to come and give a talk for the entire CS department, so whoever is interested. I'll be somewhere in this building, okay. And the current schedule is that he's supposed to talk on November 18th, okay. So as soon as I know the timing, I'll let you guys know. It's actually open to everybody, but I think you'd be probably particularly interested, okay. So those are the things that I have. These are some neat statistics. I'm sure several of you know, but if you go to searchenginewatch.com, you can get current ratings on you know, who are the various what's the share, market share of the various search engines. And these are from, I think this is the Nielsen one, and this is the searchengines.com. So you see the numbers are slightly different, actually, big difference, 36 versus 46. But in essence, Google is still not 90%. And for those of you who may have thought it's 90%, it's not. So it's more like 50% of the market at the uppermost scenario at this point of time. And then here is also an interesting thing. This is actually, I think, at least a year old. No, maybe not a year old, maybe like 4 or 5 months old. So this is what the various search engines claim as the number of pages that they actually crawled, okay. And so Google apparently currently says 8.1 billion, MSN is 5, Yahoo 4.2, and then this Ask Jeeves. Actually, the funny thing about Ask Jeeves is there is a thing for Ask Jeeves, that's just that piece, except Ask Jeeves is now kind of a crazy company. It's now become an ask.com. The people who bought Ask Jeeves don't like PG Woodhouse, and so they decided Jeeves is not a good name to have for a search engine. So they called it ask.com, and then they actually own Teoma, which is another pretty good search engine, except, you know, not enough people use it. So Teoma currently is in this others category, which has been sold to Google, you know, to Ask Jeeves in back in 2001, and then, and Ask Jeeves itself has been sold to some people recently. And so if you add Ask Jeeves, Ask part, and the Teoma part, they'll be slightly bigger, actually. The other interesting thing that these guys point out, which is nice to know, is if you have a long page, how much of the page is actually indexed? Okay, so apparently this is something that wasn't there in the anatomy paper, and so we may not have actually gone into this, but apparently there were versions of Google where it would just say you would only take the first 100K of the file. And so we'll only index the, you know, whatever comes in the first 100K. So if there is important stuff afterwards, then that page would not actually be retrieved for that. And what's interesting is more or less everybody is following that sort of a criteria. So it's 8 billion pages times 100K per page maximum. That's it. The other thing, for some weird reason, I've been spending time this weekend reading this engineering stuff. I sent you a bunch of mails for those of you who actually look at the mails. Let's see. about the engineering papers on Google, and I would particularly suggest that you read this one. In fact, I link it up from the readings list right now. Let's see, where are we? Yeah, that one. So that actually gives a few more details which are more up to date as of 2003 as to how the current Google architecture is. You know, this was way before, right? Anatomy of Google is a 1998 paper, and this one is a 2003 paper. It's very repetitive paper, actually. It's written more for IEEE Micro, and they keep talking about why it is good to buy cheap machines rather than buy dedicated hardware to do parallel processing. But as part of that, the first three pages actually have nice description of what actually happens to a query when it goes to Google. That's interesting to read. And an interesting point about parallelism in Google, which is actually present in this paper as well as a paper I suggested you consider reading in the mail archive, is that the parallelism in Google is of a very interesting, easy variety. I mean, the parallelism in search engines, if you have any idea of how parallel processing works, the trickiest part in parallel processing is, you know, the holy grail in parallel processing is linear speedup. Okay, in the sense, if you can solve the problem in 1 hour with one computer, you throw in two computers, it should be solvable in half an hour. Four computers, 15 minutes, so on. Okay, that's the best you can hope for. Okay, most of the time, you know, parallel processing, that's actually hard to reach. That's the holy grail. You cannot reach that, because most of the time what happens is there are pieces where the different, I mean, you cannot split the problem into, you know, 15,000 different pieces and then just do them all parallelly. There would be intermediate bottlenecks where things have to read each other's memory. Okay, parallel processing becomes hard because of the shared memory restriction. Okay, so processors wind up having shared memory, and you know that's the only way they can do general purpose parallel computation. Now, one of the points that is made in this paper, the paper on reduced MAPCAR reduced architecture, in essence, is that much of the parallelism in Google is of read-only variety. Okay, so one of the interesting things is, from the point of view of parallel processing, all the hard stuff is gone now. Okay, everybody is just reading. Nobody is really, the only time you modify the database, the modification is done much less frequently. That's basically updating the indices and so on. Okay, so that makes things much simpler. And you should actually look at, so they made a little set of macros, I guess, for the people at Google to write down their programs using essentially the reduce map car, reduce map ideas. And, you know, I was mentioning this, for those of you in Lisp, you know, who are used to Lisp, you can understand this. Okay, so if you want to, for example, add up the squares of the first 10 integers, let's say, okay, so what Lisp allows you to do is it allows you to do, so this is a list of thingies. Okay, and you want to square each of them, and you map square onto that list. In essence, what it will do is each of them, the square works on each of them. So now, instead of thinking of this list thing, let's say map a CPU process onto different search queries or different parts of a query process. Okay, and then after that is done, all you need to do is, in this particular case, you squared everything independently, and then you're just going to add them all up. And again, Lisp basically has this reduce construct, which takes an entire list and applies a single operation between each of the elements in the list, so that you'll get one number. You can normally reduce it using plus, minus, or multiplication, that sort of stuff. Okay. Now, this sort of view of parallel processing is quite naive, and it only makes sense for Google because it doesn't really need much more than this. It's mostly read parallelism. Okay, so you don't want to solve harder problem than you need to solve. So that's kind of nice. Okay. Should look it up. Actually, they have slides on this stuff too. It's very interesting. They show pretty much apparently every piece of Google now uses this MapReduce architecture to speed up. Okay. Okay. Any questions on any of this stuff? Yes. What? Final. I normally either have an in-class or a take-home. I haven't decided. If it's take-home, then the take-home would be given before the semester ends, and it will be due very soon after the semester ends. Okay. If it's a final, then it has to be on the real date of the final. Okay? Yes? Whichever is the next homework? Is it homework 3? Okay, then it's homework 3. Okay. I thought I gave you more homework. It's homework 3 then. Yes. Other questions? Okay. So, I'm going to continue the discussion of the data integration, information integration. I should mention a couple of caveats. This is the part of the course, I mean, in fact, integration appears prominently in the name of the course, integration, mining, and retrieval. This is the part of the course that is probably the least textbook level right now, because I don't know that the pieces have stabilized enough that I can give you a very clear-cut idea of this is information integration, nothing more is information integration. Okay? So all I can do to you is to convey to you my current understanding, which has been changing every year I teach this course. In fact, I just before coming to the class, I dumped a whole bunch of slides that were already there, and I wasn't going to discuss them because I don't think it's really worth your time. You know, it's there, but it's like, if you're only spending 1 hour talking about, in one class talking about data integration, stuff like bucket algorithm is probably no longer interesting. So I just, you know, got rid of that. And so what I would do is, you know, if you ask me next year, I may have changed my view as to what information integration is. But partly that's not just my failure. It's because I think we're all trying to figure out what is the overall problem, what are the pieces that are actually doable, and what are the challenges corresponding to various pieces. Okay, so I'll try to give you an overview, but keep asking yourself as well as me the question of how things connect. Okay, normally I do, at least I make them connect in my head, whether or not I make them connect in your head. In this case, I barely make them connect in my own head. And so you should be particularly, you know, aware of that, and then ask yourself, you know, why is he teaching this? And ask me, for example, and then I will be forced to explain to you why I'm teaching pieces. Okay. So this was a picture of information integration that I used last time, right? And it's more of an architecture-oriented thing where you have bunches of things and you want to have a uniform mediator. And then if you were to make this uniform mediator happen, what are the high-level problems that you could come up with? Okay, the first thing I want to show you is, here is a different view of information integration. I don't know that this is actually contradictory to my view. It's just another guy who's working in information integration, whose work I respect a lot, actually uses this as his overview slide for information integration. So I thought I'll show you that too, so that, you know, currently, in some sense, information integration, the problem is defined by the people doing information integration. And if I call myself as doing information integration, then I get to define the problem. Okay, that's how actually most problems that you are learning have started. It's just that after a while, some majority view prevails, and then everything else goes away. I mean, if you take something like databases, when databases started, there were like very, you know, many different views of how to, what is the right model for databases. In some sense, there would be 5-6 models of databases that would be taught in the introductory courses. You know, nowadays, at least, you know, 2 years back, people are only teaching relational model, that's it, because everything else is just fallen by the wayside. So relational model is one, so you only need to know that. Now, of course, again, we are going away from relational model. Okay. So anyway, so this is another slightly different view of information integration. So you have discovering information from sources. Now, again, the word data integration versus information integration, you know, I'm almost, in my own lectures, I tend to use them synonymously, but they're not synonymous. Data integration, at least, there are data tuples. Information integration, information is a generally defined term, okay, where data tuples are information, text is information, pictures are information, anything is information. Okay. So this guy, this is actually William Cohen, who's done pretty nice work, and we'll talk about some of his stuff on soft joins during this class. So his view is you have bunches of databases, you know, information sources, which are basically in the deep web. The word deep web, the phrase deep web, how many of you know what deep web is? Okay, deep web is the name for data sources that are accessible via web. Are information sources that are accessible via web. So after your query, the information comes out. And we meant, you know, I spent a lot of time in this course saying that, in fact, web is not just pages. You know, many of them are essentially data sources with a page in the front. And that page is a form. And then you fill the form, and they'll give you information at that point of time. And this has been called deep web because, in essence, this web is inaccessible mostly to search engines. And by different people's estimates, deep web is much bigger than shallow web, way bigger. You know, I think 10 orders, 100 orders of magnitude bigger. I can send you links on what are various people's guesses as to how big it is. Okay. So in essence, there's a lot more in these data sources that is out there. You know, these information sources out there, and you get them, you have to find these data sources. This is like a problem-centered view. My previous slide can be thought of as an architecture-centered view. You know, I don't actually explain to you what the problem is other than at a very high level, saying I just want a big mediator in between, okay? This is way more about problem-centered. Okay, let's see what is the problem. Okay, so the problem here is you have multiple data sources and you want to gather data from them. So for example, discovering sources is important, first of all. Okay, and then if you have a source, then you need to know if it has a schema, then you want to learn that schema. So basically, you want to know the regularity about the data that's being exported by the source. Okay, so those are some of the issues in discovering the information. Then gathering the information. Gathering essentially is, for example, unwrapping the data. So that's part of information extraction, wrapper learning, for example. And then after you got all this data, then the interesting part, this is actually something that I didn't talk much about, which is linking data from different sources. Linking data from different sources. And that in essence means, I mentioned this last class, whether you wind up joining a piece of information you get from one source to another source. Okay, what I was talking about as joining is actually the issue that is brought up in linking. Okay, so the important thing that they're essentially talking about in linking is, what if different objects are called by different names? I mean, the same object has been called by different names in different sources. So for example, I have one source which says S Kambham Party and some information. Another source which says Rao Kambham Party and has some information. I would like to be able to join on Rao Kambham Party equal to S Kambham Party. That would be a nice way of actually, you know, if I know that this is the same as this, then I can join the data, right? And to be able to do that, I have to map these two objects, which are completely different in their print method. Okay, so this is object mapping. It's sort of an object level issue of something that we already talked about, which is if you have a virtual schema, if you have two different data sources with two different schema, how do you map them? What attribute here corresponds to what attribute here? That's a schema mapping issue. Okay. Now you actually sort of deal with all the schema mapping here, and then you come here. Now you have to deal with object mapping. Okay. So that's been called linkage and linking records from different places. Now, linking is, if in fact the records come in the exact same representation, so here is that common party, here is that common party, linking means joining from a database point of view. If they are not, then you have to actually say this is the same as this, and the moment you do the mapping, then you can link. Okay, so a lot of work, in fact, that's done in by people who call themselves information integration researchers is about linking objects. Okay, and then after you, so in essence, this he calls this whole thing as a phase of cleaning data. Okay, so he got all this data from various sources, and he's trying to clean it. And cleaning involves removing duplicates, or at least if there are duplicates, knowing that they are duplicates. Not necessarily removing, but at least knowing that the information here is the same as the information here. Okay? And similarly knowing that the record here, the name of the record here is the same as the name of the record here, which means you're making a link between different names. And so you can then do join. Okay? And once you do this, then you have sort of a data tuples that you can, you know, identifiable data tuples, like, you know, relational data tuples. At this point, you can then subject them to all the database-y things, such as asking queries about this data. Now, in fact, in this particular slide, they leave the open the possibility that you want to form a single database. It doesn't have to be a single database that lives on your desk. It could be a single database that's a virtual database, where once you give the query, it suddenly then sends queries to various people. Okay, so I have, in fact, even though it looks as if this is sort of like a data warehousing approach, which we were talking about last class, it's not necessary. You could do data warehousing or virtual. Okay, and then finally, if you have that kind of, then what sort of things can you do? I mean, of course, you want to query. You know, you want to query this integrated view of all these sources. Okay. And when you can query any sort of things. I mean, you can query specific, simple queries saying, you know, what is the, you know, give a SQL query, or give more of a data analysis kind of a query, which is like mining for regularities in the data and so on. Okay, so this stuff is sort of the same as my view, the previous picture. Okay, I guess the one thing that this view brings up more to the fore is this issue that you are going to spend some time linking data from different sources. Okay. Now, one other thing that I want to mention is, so both this and this are very general pictures. Okay. So the question would be actually what exists right now and what are the special cases that do exist currently. And we looked at some of them last class. So for example, shopping agents exist, which comparison shopping agents exist, okay, which basically bring data from multiple sources selling the same object and then put it in one aggregated form for you. Are they information integration? Are they doing information integration? Yes. Are they most general information integration? No, because they don't have to do much of linking, for example. Because all the information that is being exported by every source is of the same relation. It's basically the same relation is being exported from all the sources. Okay? So I want to actually differentiate the following three. So this is like general information integration, whatever that is. And I'll give some names to some three special cases at least, and hopefully I'll have more special cases if I can think of, but these are well-known special cases. One is the data aggregation special case. Okay. Again, the names are not particularly standardized. I just made these names up so that I can talk to you about these special cases that do exist. In data aggregation, it is information integration, but here, in essence, you assume that all sources export parts of a single relation. Okay, all sources are really exporting a part of a single relation. Okay, for example, they may all be exporting the relation employment opportunity. They may all be exporting the relation buying record for a particular product. Okay, what that essentially means is the aspects of taking information from one source and joining with information in another source, that doesn't arise. right? Because everybody, you know, you don't actually join in, if you are looking, if you're searching employment opportunities, if I provide you a single employment opportunity database, which kind of culls data from all the employment opportunities, right? I would call that an aggregation service rather than integration in a general sense, because you, it's not like you take an employment opportunity from Washington Post and feed it into the New York Times database. There's no point in doing it. What you might want to do is take the employment opportunity from Washington Post and feed it into some map service, which will tell you the address of the area, or feed into some other service which will tell you quality of life in the city where the employment opportunity exists. You understand what I'm saying? So, however, that's, again, when you do that, you're doing general information integration, okay? So here you're actually just looking at one relation, variations of one single relation being exported by different sources. Now this is, in essence, the most, currently most popular and most sort of profitable thing. Everybody who made money off of information integration just did this. Okay, they'll call it in different names, but essentially Jungly did this, Transformic did this, all the shopping agents are doing this. Okay, now this is, all I want you to understand is this is more less general than the overall problem. It's a, you know, some, in some sense it's a more specific problem. Now when you have, when you go to a specific problem, certain problems become, certain challenges become more prominent than other challenges. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if I know that I don't have to deal with joins, etc., then that doesn't necessarily mean there are no other problems. Some other problems which were simmering below because we didn't even know how to do joins start coming up, and you start actually paying attention to them. Okay, so oftentimes, so again, said this sort of system could be either warehouse or virtual integration. It turns out the warehouse versus virtual integration is actually orthogonal to this distinction that I'm making across the board. Okay, so you could do data aggregation with warehouse architecture, data organization, data aggregation with virtual architecture. Both are possible. Once again, if you must pick, most of the profitable, currently profitable commercial ventures just went with data warehousing approach. Okay, and we talked about when is warehousing versus virtual integration preferred last class, and we'll talk a little bit again today. Okay. So there are some examples there, and then so the challenges that are actually that come out when you look at this special case is obviously schema mapping. Even though everybody is sending the same one relation, but they may still be calling the pieces of the relation by different names. So you at least need to say that this field here corresponds to this field here. Okay, it's not given one single, I mean two. Given just two sources, that mapping is very easy. But it's painful to do it for 4,000 sources, if there are 4,000 sources. Okay, so that's an interesting problem that needs to be dealt with. The other is the data overlap. So for example, you do need to be able to see in these cases, so here is the question. Suppose the same entity is being sold under slightly different names by two different sellers. So one guy would call it NB 856, which is New Balance 856 shoes. Another guy would call it New Balance something something 856. And they have, you know, one guy is selling it for $50, one guy is selling it for $70. So if you are trying to aggregate, you better actually aggregate such that these two names, you do have to realize that these two names are the same. Okay, so in fact, one of the interesting things is you do need to realize the data overlap. So the same tuple might be exported by different sources. Same tuple may be exported by different sources. Okay, and when that is the case, if their name is exactly the same, you know at least you want to then compare which is the cheaper and then put it in the right order. If they're not the same, then you need to link them. So there are aspects of linking do come here, okay, if you wind up having different names for the same object. But you are not doing the join. All you are trying to do is putting like tuples close to each other. so that then you can either do some sort of a grouping. You're trying to do grouping. Think about it that way. To do grouping, you still need to realize that, you know, certain things are talking about the same object. Okay. That's one thing. So we'll talk about some issues involved in actually managing data overlap as we go along in the context of BibFinder. Okay. The other one, from the structured data side, so this is one extreme, which is all of them are supporting only single relation, in a sense, okay, except maybe with the names changed. Here, the other extreme is to say that each data source is sending a different relation. It's each data source is sending a different table. Okay, this is more like what happens in your databases, right? I mean, so each, you know, normally, if you have a large universal relation, you normalize it into multiple tables, right? And then each table, suppose you put each table in a different data source. So for example, the addresses converted to maps, that's one table. Employment opportunity is a different table, which has address in it. And you may want to be able to link the address here to the map there. Okay? If you do this, then this is essence, this brings up all of them the same relation. So it's sort of vertical data integration. The important issues wind up becoming how to deal with overlap between tuples. And on this extreme, the horizontal extreme, what you're doing is each relation, there is a single source that's sending it. Okay? And the issues become making sure that the right tuples align correctly so that you can do joins over them. Okay? So this, I just made up this name, data linking, but people do call it horizontal data integration. Now, general data integration is both horizontal and vertical. So you could have multiple relations. For each relation, there are four databases or five databases that are sending that relation in different forms. So there are like five mapping sources, 10,000 employment opportunity sources, and 15,000, different shopping sources. Okay, so there is vertical this way, and there is also horizontal this way. Okay. Now, most of the work that's been done is either like at the vertical level or just purely horizontal level. Now, unfortunately, in the purely horizontal level, there are no fielded systems that you would recognize. Because by definition, what happens is the purely horizontal integration is more useful for the guy who needs that query to be answered. So a classic case, for example, is, remember I gave you that NSF thing where they wanted to do is find out, what is the total amount of money they're giving to historically black and minority colleges. Now, nobody else is interested. If the NSF were to solve this problem generally and put a website on top, it's not going to get like a million hits every day. Only NSF is interested. Okay, but for NSF, it means a big deal. Okay, so part of the reason is this sort of horizontal integration happens, or at least I think it happens. I mean, I haven't been in every company in the world, but when it happens, the company or the corporation has to deal with it, and they're happy that they've dealt with it. So there are principles of how to deal with horizontal integration that we will talk about. Okay, but I cannot show you, dot-com sites which do this, or I cannot show you the millionaires who became millionaires because they sold a horizontal data integration company. Okay, now the general data integration, as I said, should have both. And since I can't show you any which involve this, I can't also show you anything that's general than these two, other than just these. Okay, most of the dot-com varieties are actually yet on the top. Okay, finally, the challenges in this, actually we'll look at it today, is of course the linkage is an issue. Okay. If there are two objects in two different databases, you need to realize whether they are the same or not. And the classic case, in fact, NSF decided to fund information integration because they couldn't solve this little query, right? And the Department of Defense is deciding to fund information integration research because Ted Kennedy once got stopped in Washington National Airport because his name was on the, you know, terrorist list. Okay. And I know that a bunch, at least half of the Americans actually probably believe that Ted Kennedy probably is one, but, you know, in an objective sense, he's not really a terrorist. And the problem was there was a little database which has things like T. Kennedy, and this guy is T. Kennedy, so they stopped him. Now, Ted Kennedy is not the only guy who got stopped for this sort of situation. I mean, there have been two-year-old kids who were stopped because they are, you know, a threat to the national security. Okay, but, you know, they're not Ted Kennedy, so we don't know about them. So the issue there essentially was linkage. Okay, there is a T. Kennedy there. There's a T. Kennedy in front of you. Are they the same object? Okay, and I mean, we had actually people standing in front, and they still obviously could not do linkage. Either that, or they just really didn't like Ted Kennedy. But either way, those are the kind of issues that you know, come up, which make Department of Defense is spending a lot of money trying to support this kind of data linking. Okay. Then, now again, one of the other things I should mention is that when I said information integration, you could actually have text sources, you could have structured data tuples, and you can also have images. Okay. In fact, one of the big integration issues, for example, is how would you deal with geological information sources. So basically, if you have maps of various places, okay. So I mean, all the data that you need is out there somewhere. It's just that you don't know how to put it together. So one of the guys, Craig Knobloch, who, you know, whose name appears here, whose work you read earlier, he was talking one time about this work that they did, wherein apparently in Los Angeles, you know, under various real estate properties, there are abandoned oil wells. Okay, there used to be oil in Los Angeles, right? And there is actually a government agency which keeps track of where are the oil wells. And there is another government agency which keeps track of where are the houses. All of them sort of work in different, I mean, you think that they both should take just latitude, longitude, and tell you whether or not they're there. But, you know, obviously this guy will have a separate input, different input, and this guy will have a different input. And so what these guys, Craig and his group, were doing was to link these two databases so that people can tell whether or not there's an oil well, an abandoned oil well, sitting under their house, or the house that they're about to buy, which is a useful information. I'm sure you'd like to pay for it if you're just about to buy a house and you think there is an abandoned oil well. Okay. Now, to be able to do that, they're again talking about linking, except, you know, you're also doing linking in the context of essentially maps, latitudes and longitudes. Okay. Now, if you were to read a paper on a geological information source integration, it won't look at all like a database paper. Okay, there won't be any, I mean, they may say join every once in a while, but really, it's a, you know, there are separate problems that come up that are much more front and center. Okay, that too is information integration. Now, on this side, actually, this is one part of information integration, a very special case that you are all quite familiar with. This is a collection selection problem, which is if all your databases just export text documents, each database, you know, just exports a text document. Okay, so you could have bibliography sources, okay, or you could just have news sources, or you could have search engines, individual search engines. Okay, and what I want to do is just have one single interface to all these sources, which will take queries and then give me answers. Now, notice that again, in these cases, on this side, I tried to talk in terms of data, so you are thinking of SQL queries. But here I'm talking about text data, so you are thinking of keyword queries. And so I'm providing a keyword query to the mediator, which then sends it to multiple text sources. And then gets the answers and shows it to you. Okay. So examples of such work are things like Metacrawler, which is a Metacrawler, and I think Dogpile is another one, which is, these are basically meta search engines, which will call multiple search engines to take your queries. Now, of course, the issues there, for example, are deduplication. You don't want to have 15 copies of the same answer in the first 10. And each, you can be sure that each search engine will have a slightly different text summary for the same source, for the same URL and the same query. Okay? And so if you actually compare even the text summaries, they would be different. And so you, if you just look at the identicalness, they will all be non-identical, and you can wind up putting multiple copies of the same thing, all of which are identical for humans, but non-identical for something which just does, you know, text comparison, direct text comparison. So you need to do similarity checking. Okay? So you need to be able to make sure that you are removing the duplicates and then collating the results. That's the minimum. In fact, the original Metacrawler, only thing that it does is just removes the duplicates. That's it. Okay. And I think that was worth what? 100 million or something. That's what they sold it for. So, you know, if you are in the right time, that's nice thing to do. But then there's a lot more that has happened in collection selection. One of the interesting things in collection selection, as it is the case in pretty much all of information integration, and especially in these two, is calling only the sources that are likely to be relevant. Calling only the sources that are likely to be relevant. In particular, if you have a virtual integration architecture, okay, then as soon as you get a query, you don't want to wake up everybody whose address you know and saying, wake up and, you know, I have a query. Do you have anything for it? You could do it. That's a reasonable thing to do, except it just doesn't scale. You know, as the number of sources increase, for every little query which has nothing to do with the source, you are calling that source anyway. Okay. So one of the interesting things would be to, this is sort of the issue of data overlap here and document overlap here and relevance in general. So what source is likely to be relevant to the query that you have in hand? And only call a few of them rather than all of them. Okay. Right now, actually, there aren't any economic imperatives that make you call a few sources, either it's all sources, because, you know, everybody can create as much traffic as they want on the web. But in general, if everybody creates, you know, for every, you know, if to the extent information integration becomes actually much more feasible, and everybody is sending every query to everybody else on the web, even Internet 2.0 is not going to do it for you. It's just unnecessary amount of extra traffic. Okay, so it makes sense to actually reason about source relevance when the query comes in, and then only call the sources that are likely to be actually useful. Okay, and if you are like a broker, that's what you do. If you are an outsourcing guy, you know, when you get a job, you're not going to call everybody that you know and say, we have a job, let's all start tracking. You actually wake up only those people who you think are relevant for the job that you have on hand. Okay. We do this all the time. It's basically for economic reasons. Okay. So those are like three different pieces. And one of the interesting things is papers on collection selection don't normally talk of themselves as information integration at all. They get published in information retrieval community. There are problems that they solve which wind up being similar to the problems that these guys have to solve, and yet they're different. They just get published in different places. Okay. And similarly, between these two tend to be published more often in the database community, but they barely have cross-citation. Okay, because the issues that are more important here versus the ones that are more important here are different. For the most general information integration problem, all of these are important, but that nobody is actually solving the entire one. So, you know, we define the entire space, and then people go off to different places and work there. So that's essentially where information integration currently is. Is that confusing enough? Okay. So here are a couple more dimensions that we want to consider in general when you are designing an information integration system of any of those varieties. You know, some of these are more important for some rectangles than others, and you can decide as you read this. So for example, how many sources are we accessing? How autonomous are the sources? Okay, would they cooperate with you or would they not cooperate with you? Last time I basically assumed that people would never, other sources don't even know that there is a mediator which is actually mediating over them. But that's one extreme. The other extreme is you basically buy the privilege to mediate over a source. That's the other extreme. Okay? And so it does matter as to which, you know, which whether or not they're cooperating with you. Okay, and then if they are very autonomous and they're not cooperative, then they won't give you any information about how the data is organized in them. Okay, so the metadata about the sources is not there for picking. You need to learn it. You need to learn it in a sneaky way. So you kind of send probing queries and look at the answers that they give and figure out that, oh, this must be your schema. Whereas if they are cooperating, they're standing in the front door and saying, here is our schema, please take it. Okay, so now which, you know, in one case there is a problem that you have to solve, basically learning the statistics. Another case there is no problem because they'll give it to you. Okay. Is the data structured? That's a big deal. We did see this. I mean, whether it is structured data such as database tuples versus complete text, which is collection selection, versus in between, where, for example, in fact, we'll talk about one information integration scenario where you will look at there are data sources which have text fields. Okay? And you need to, and the fields will never be exactly identical. And so you actually can't, so there would be, let's say, a title of a movie, and somebody or other would make some mistake in the title of the movie. Okay, The Graduate, Graduate. And the question is, are these two different movies or the same movie? Okay, I mean, Graduate is a movie, and I think it is it a The Graduate or Graduate? Do you guys remember? What? You're telling me. Do any of you guys know? Because Indians actually just introduce articles when they are not needed and remove them when they are needed. So, you know, both of us together can sort, you know, support each other and still not make any sense. So, but if you have The Graduate and Graduate in two different pieces, they're not the same. If you're just doing text comparison, and yet you need to be able to say they're the same. Who will support you in that sort of a scenario? You need to do the distance between these two values, okay? And you would realize that the is a very common word, okay? So if you do TF, IDF weighting, the would just go out. We from India just do TF, IDF on all the articles and got rid of them long back. So every paper I write, they'll always, in the reviewers, they'll say, you know, you should consider articles once in a while. But that's, and I did IDF analysis and got rid of them. But the point is, the missing is okay, because it's a very, you know, common word. And so they are actually quite close to each other. Okay, and if you do that, if you say they're quite close to each other, you can then do joins over close equalities rather than strict equalities. These are called soft joins. And so here is a scenario, you're doing database stuff with TF-IDF stuff. And in fact, the Cohen, the guy whose picture that I showed you earlier, whose information taking picture, he's actually done this system called World, which works exactly on movie reviews, data sources. And it can do joins between multiple sources which have textual attributes. And to see whether or not the textual attributes are equal, they use TF-IDF technique. TF-IDF is not the only thing. For example, one guy says graduate, G-R-A-D-U-A-T-E, one guy says G-R-A-D-U-I-T. Okay, and a lot of us have problems in spelling. Okay, so is it the same? Okay, or one guy says graduate with T, another guy says graduate with E-T. Is that the same? Now, there are a whole series of distance metrics between strings, okay, called edit distance metrics. So how close is one string to another string in terms of edit distance? Hamming code is one aspect of it, but edit distance in general are in terms of the simple operations you can do on strings. How many of those simple operations do you have to do to convert one string to another string? The more, the farther they are. The less, the closer they are. And TF-IDF is telling you distance between text. And edit distances are telling you distances between strings. And you can do both of them based on your scenario and throw them into the databases, and you can do soft join. Okay. Now, in that case, you essentially have semi-structured data. It's not all text, not all structured, somewhere in between. Okay. It's nice to be able to give these small examples where things work, but there is no single overarching system which does everything. That's unfortunately the less satisfactory thing. Okay. Each little piece you ask me, I can give you a cute example which does that. I mean, a cute system which does that. Okay. So that's the data structured or not structured. Supporting just queries are also updates. This is a big deal, very big deal. Okay, this is all connected to read-only versus read-write memory. So are you able to change the sources or are you just asking them questions? Okay, most overwhelming majority of information integration systems are supporting only reads, not writes. Because if you have any background in databases, you know, I think we actually talked about it when we went through views, and we'll actually connect up database views to information integration in the next few slides. And when we get there, you'll realize that updates, in essence, will wind up becoming updating a database through its view. And that's a pretty hard problem. Okay, so imagine this. So I have a view which gives the average salary of all the employees in ASU. Average salary. Okay, so you ask me what's the average salary of ASU, and you know this mediator says, yeah, this much money. Now you say, I just want to change it. You know, make the average salary be $15 more than what you have. How do you change the database such that database will be consistent with what change you made right now? Do you see the problem? I can't just willy-nilly change the average without telling people exactly how to make the difference in the individual tuples. Okay, I mean, there are a million ways in which you can change the individual professor salaries. You know, if you ask me, I say 15 times the number of employees, give me that money, I'll take it as my salary, that will increase the average by $15. Okay, I'm very happy to do it, but you know, I'm sure you too are. Okay, there are many, many ways of doing this, and which is the right way of changing the database, given that you're trying to change the view. Okay, so it's a much harder problem. Requirements. This is actually a very interesting issue. We'll spend a lot of time on this. When you have an integration system, what are the requirements? What is your performance metric? When do you know that you have done it right? Okay, in databases, you know what is it to do it right? Okay, the answer is pre-specified basically. And whoever gives it faster wins. That's it. Okay. So our question now is, it's more like IR. Okay. You have accuracy, which is basically precision, completeness, which is recall. Okay. And performance, which is who does it faster. Handling inconsistencies. You want to do precision, recall, all this stuff while dealing with the fact that some data tuples are probably inconsistent with other data tuples. Now, how do you handle those? Okay, all of these issues are there. And, you know, depending on, so you need to almost decide what your requirements are. And then you can say whether or not the system you design is capturing that. Okay. Yes? I can't hear you. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of. If it's actual duplicate, then whoever gives the most new results wins. So that sort of gets taken care of in the precision and recall issue. Okay? So if you give the same result 15 times, your recall doesn't increase. I hope. Your impatience might increase, but your recall doesn't increase. 15 copies of the first answer is still one copy of the first answer, right? And so, to the extent you want to increase your recall while keeping precision high, you are automatically guaranteed that, and then you want to also have a good performance, you're automatically gravitating towards methods that will take care of duplicate. But actually, that's what you just did is an exercise that I hope people who are still awake would continue doing when you go back, which is, you know, I just wrote some names here as to what are the issues. For example, accuracy, completeness, performance, handling, inconsistency. Are there more that people should care about in information integrity systems? Come up with new ones and see if they are subsumed by existing ones. If not, you know, tell me that there's more. Okay. And then this I won't even get into. In essence, part of the answer to this depends on this. So the question is, do you think that the data sources have closed world or open world assumptions? So for example, it winds up making a difference. So for example, I want to only see movies that have not yet played in New York. Yeah, that have not yet played in New York. That's what I'm interested in. Now, suppose there is a source which says, I generally have, you know, movies that have played in New York. Okay? Now, one obvious idea that you will come up with is, okay, look at this movie and see if it is present in that source. If so, then Rao should not be asked to look at it. If it's not present in the source, then Rao should go ahead and look and see this movie. However, what if the guy who is maintaining the New York source is a lazy bum, and he threw in a couple of ones which definitely did play in New York, but did not make sure that he put in everything that played in New York? So they provided, the source provided precision but not recall. I mean, the source provided accuracy but not completeness. Normally, source not being complete is okay. If your question is, give me some movies that have played in New York, this source would be quite good in answering your query. If your question is, give me some movies that have not played in New York, then you need to know whether or not, it's not enough to say whether the source is correct, but you also want to know whether it's complete. Do you understand what I'm saying? Complete essentially is closed world assumption. So whatever I say is all truth and nothing but the truth. Okay, so if I don't put it there, you can be sure that it never played in New York. That's a different kind of guarantee than saying, if I did put it there, you can be sure that it played in New York. Okay, for those of you who have background in logic, you know that negation is a nasty little thing. Okay, whenever you have negation is when all sorts of fun stuff happen. And if you want to handle negated queries correctly, you need to know whether there's a closed world or open world. In fact, there's another reason to know closed world versus open world assumption. Suppose I want to ask a different question, which is, give me all the movies that ever played in New York. Now, a source says, here are some movies that played in New York. Now, if it also says, I pretty much know for sure that all the movies, and that I have listed all the movies that ever played in New York, then after I call that source, I don't have to call anybody else. If not, after I call this guy, I also have to call every other source which has information about movies in any cities in USA, on the off chance that one of them will give me extra movie that wasn't listed in the first one. Do you see what I'm saying? So if you have closed world statements about sources, then you can cut down the amount of time you take to do the query processing. If not, you would have to call anybody else who might still have extra answers. In fact, one interesting thing we will look at is a variation of closed world assumption called local closed world assumption. Okay? A source may not be able to give you a guarantee that everything that is worth having according to its relation is actually present. So if I suppose I'm a movie source, right? I may not be able to give you the guarantee. Even IMDb cannot give the guarantee. IMDb is the Internet Movie Database. Okay? It cannot give the guarantee that every movie that has ever been made is present in its database. So what does that mean? If you have a query about movies, you call IMDb, then you also have to call everybody else. You know, Rav's movie database and Nick's movie database and somebody else's movie database to see maybe somebody else will give extra answers. Okay. Now, IMDb may not be able to say that I have all the movies that have ever been made, but they may well be able to say that we definitely have all the movies made in USA. Or they may be able to say, we definitely have all the movies made after 1959. Or they could say, we definitely have all the movies made by Zhang Yimou, who is a Chinese director, but, you know, whose movies seem to be quite popular in outside of China. Okay? They can make this. So, here is a big movie site, but I can tell you there are pieces that I can guarantee that they are closed. And so if your query is in that subset, then you don't have to ask anybody else. Do you understand that? Okay, so there are variations of closed world assumptions called local closed world assumptions that can be used to improve performance. Okay. Let me see what we should do here. So let me introduce a topic that we'll be talking more next class, so that I won't just stop in the midstream. Okay. So we will start, having looked at all these high level issues, let's talk a little about models of information, models of general information integration. Okay. And then after that, I will go off and talk about query processing issues for specific models, such as data aggregation versus collection selection. Okay. So I would talk about features that I, you know, have good understanding of. But I did tell you that the overall problem is much bigger than what I will probably talk about. Okay. So if you're talking about models for information integration, and for now let's assume all is structured data for now. Okay. So basically relational database support. So we already talked about data warehousing approach last time. I don't have to go through this slide again. Okay. What are the pluses and what are the minuses? The pluses for the warehousing approach is you just put all the data in and be done with it. Okay. And after that, it's just a simple database problem. So it's now, even though user thinks that they are actually talking to multiple sources, in reality, the mediator is only talking to the cached database that's right next to it. And so it can have all the statistics of that particular database. It can do very optimal query processing on that database, all that fun stuff. So it's really a database problem after that. Okay? However, I did mention that the negatives on this are, A, you may not be actually able to download all the data in the data sources, legally at least. And sometimes it's also not possible theoretically. You know, even if it's legally possible, it may not be possible to ask enough questions to get all the data out. You know, depending on how many restrictions they put on the access to the database. And a more important thing is the data might be changing very fast. And so there are certain types of data, such as stock quotes, where, you know, putting it all in the middle is basically useless. So data warehousing works when the cost of putting it all in the central storage is amortized over multiple queries which can use that cache. Data warehousing is a caching strategy. So when are caches good? You know, caches are good when, you know, the effort you put in making the cache is paid off by the number of people who use that cache and not get yelled at for giving stale data answers. Okay? So that's the data warehousing approach. This is virtual integration approach where you leave the sources where they belong, where they are. You know, just leave the sources. The data remains at the sources. The data remains at the sources. Okay, and so all basically you do is when the user's query comes, and now here I'm talking about both horizontal and vertical integration. So there may be some sources which have the same relation being exported by them, And there are some sources which are exporting pieces of different different relations in essence. So you can do joins over them and so on. Okay, so the user's query comes. The first thing you need to do is you need to essentially convert this query into a set of queries onto individual sources. And then ship them off to the sources and get the answers online and do whatever you want to do with them. Combine them, join them, deduplicate them, link them, and give the answer. This is online heavy. This approach is online heavy. The other one is offline heavy. You know, the warehousing is completely offline heavy. And this is useful for certain different, so basically they are useful for different scenarios. And as I mentioned last time, depending on the data, if part of your data is fast changing and part of it is stable, then you could have a half warehouse and half, virtual integration. Now, that's not surprising at all. That's like having caches for remote databases. And caches don't have the entire database. They normally just have pieces of it. Okay. So when the query comes in, you determine the relevant sources to the query. You break down the query into subqueries for the sources. And then you get the answers from the sources. You combine them appropriately. And you give it back. Okay. This is your virtual integration. Probably this is what you would think of when you heard of data integration. Okay, the other one is sort of cheating. You know, it looks as if it's cheating. You know, you said data integration, but you really made it into a single database. You know, but you know, so it's kind of a. What it also means is it has all sorts of interesting, interesting issues that we could talk about. The most important issue that we actually spend some time talking about starting today and into the next class is this issue of how are the sources, there is a schema for the sources. Individual sources have their own schema. The mediator has a schema. That's basically a mediator schema. Right? There should be a way in which you connect the mediator schema to the source schema. And you say basically the different relations in the source schema correspond to these different things in the the different relations in the mediator schema correspond to these different things in the source schema. Okay? So the question is, how would you make that connection? How do you map the source schemas to the mediator schema? Okay? And first, before we actually go into, there are two interesting answers, and we'll talk about that. We'll spend some time talking about those two answers. Before we go into that, let's actually ask about what would be if I come up with a solution, how would I know whether or not it's a good solution? You know, if I have a mapping, approach, what should I be looking for in the mapping approach I'm trying to make? Okay? So here are some of the interesting issues. One is you want to be able to have expressive power, which is the way you are mapping should be expressive enough that you can make out differences, minute differences, between sources and how they connect to the mediator schema. And the more minute you get to, the more filtering you can do when the query comes. Okay, think about it this way. You are again an outsourced guy, right? And if all your programmers that you have put in different places, in the backyard, and then you are getting all the programming projects and you're sending it to them, right? Now, one, you are asking basically the question, how do I characterize in my own mind all these programmers? The simplest is they're all programmers, which basically means whenever the program job comes, I wake up all of them and say, hey, do it, which is a waste of time for everybody because only one guy needs to do it. Okay, a second level, these are C programmers here, these are Lisp programmers here, there are some other programmers here. And then when the problem comes, depending on your analysis, if you think it requires Lisp expertise, you only call the Lisp guy. You can also say that these are rapid prototyping kind of programmers. These are much more optimization-oriented programmers. And depending on the problem, you can then decide which ones to ask. The more of a mental picture you have of your subordinates, the better job you can do, giving them the problems that you are supposed to be solving, but you got them to solve for you. And in virtual mediation, essentially, these are all outsourced data. These are basically all the offshore location for you, and you're trying to decide which query to send to who. And the more information you have about them, the better off you are in deciding who is actually most relevant. Okay. The other one is easy addition. Whatever is the way of mapping, it better be the case that when there's an extra source, I should not have to redo the mapping for everybody who's already existing. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, this may not, you would think that most reasonable mapping strategies would make sure that this kind of modularity exists, but it's not obvious. In fact, we'll look at two reasonably obvious ones. One has this property, one doesn't. Okay? So easy addition is important. The other one is reformulation. Whatever the query comes, you should be able to easily reformulate the user's query into separate queries into this database. The easier it is, the better off you are. If it turns out that the reformulation is an NP-hard problem, and you get to do it online after the query has been submitted to you, it's not fun. And I'll actually show you that we'll actually talk about these two approaches called global as view and local as view approaches, both of which wind up striking extreme trade-offs in this dimension. So global as view winds up having very cheap reformulation costs. In fact, global as view is like almost what I give to my customers is the tight union of what my backyard programmers can do. So I almost sell my abilities in terms of my programmer name. And when the query comes, I pretty much know which programmer is supposed to do this query. Okay? So reformulation is like macro rewriting. You know, you ever see macro and you just get in line. There's no reformulation really. However, whenever you have such a tight mapping, when I wind up getting a new programmer in my backyard, I have to redo my entire, you know, exported schema to the outside world. Actually, I have to redo the mapping. You'll see the specifics of it. Okay? So it won't be modular. If you want reformulation ease, then modularity is gone. Then local as view will give you very easy reformulation, very easy addition. And it turns out to have NP-hard reformulation cost. Okay? And now what's interesting is both of them can be understood in terms of views on databases. This is something that we'll discuss next class. It turns out global as view uses virtual views and local as view uses materialized views. To understand them, all you need to understand is database views. Okay. And let me say the last thing and then you get to go home, which is non-lossiness. Okay, here is an interesting issue. If there is a query that comes to me, right? Now, if this guy cut the middleman and went to the backyard programmer, they could have written that program. But the middleman, because he or she has such a high-level view of the capabilities of the programmer, thinks it can't be done. Oh, my guys, oh, they don't understand this. You know, they won't be able to do it. And whereas, if you actually went, you would realize that most of these guys are closed list programmers. So they do see, but they also do list. Okay? And you didn't have strong enough model of your own sources. And so in this case, what happens is mediator is lossy. That means there were queries that could have been answered by the individual data sources, or the union of individual data sources, if you just went to them directly, but can't be answered because there's a mediator. Now remember that the reason you want to cut the middleman out is exactly this. You are always worried that the middleman is basically leading to lossy transactions. Okay, maybe middleman is eating up most of the profit you could make, or maybe middleman is actually saying something can't be done when it can be done. Now, whenever you have a middleman, this is actually possible. You know, you think that your travel agent, whether it is the one that sits in STA Travel or the one that sits in Expedia, is doing the undecidable problem of finding the optimal travel that I just sent you in email? No. So when they are in doubt, they say, oh, no, this is not the optimal. Whatever I say is the optimal. And they're actually misleading you. Okay? The ideal mediators would not have lossiness. So that's another interesting thing that you want to have. You want to be able to map the sources in such a way that there is no lossiness. And one of the things we'll find is local as view is less lossy than global as view. And global as view is the one for which the formulation is easy. So when we come back to next class, I'll talk a little bit about global as view, local as view. You can look at the slides and prepare yourself. And then we'll go from there to query processing issues in data aggregation scenarios. Okay?